ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. I'm Claire Nichols, and later Michael Muhammad Ahmed will join me for an important conversation. We'll be talking about a book inspired by a terrible true life experience. But first, we're getting a little weird. An angel is plummeting to Earth to help an oil tycoon make the final transition from life to death. I am so pleased to tell you that George Saunders is here on The Book Show. He is the man behind the Booker-winning novel Lincoln in the Bardo, and even better than that, he is one of my favourite people to talk to about the act of writing. Now, George teaches writing and literature at Syracuse University. He has thought about this stuff deeply. I am forever recommending his book on writing, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. But now George has finished another novel, and like his previous work, it is strange and ghostly and very distinctly him. It's called Vigil. George Saunders, welcome back to The Book Show.
It's so, you know, I've been looking forward to this all day, Claire. I saw it on the schedule. I'm like, oh, I get to talk to Claire. So thank you for having me back.
It's a thrill for me too. I think we should give everyone a taste, George, of the kind of weird and wonderful world you've created here for Vigil. Can you read a short section from the start of the book?
I can. Yeah, this will just be the first section. What a lovely home I found myself plummeting toward, acquiring as I fell arms, hands, legs, feet, all of which, as usual, became more substantial with each passing second. Below, a fountain. At the center of the fountain, a gold-plated statue of a dog. Someone must have really loved that dog. In the mouth of the golden dog, a golden duck. The duck's beak was hanging open in death, and a pocked area in its flank seemed meant to represent the entry field of the shot cluster. I observed all of this as I plummeted past, and then my head and torso pierced the asphalt crust of a semicircular drive and lodged in the dirt below. My rear was in the air, my fresh new legs bicycling energetically. I found myself alternately clothed and unclothed. That is to say, one instant naked and the next clothed, or to be more precise, partly clothed. Over time, that is, the elements of my outfit grew more reliably visible. My beige skirt soon became a near constant. Meanwhile, here was a burrowing worm to consider and a brown bottle shard and the rich smell of the loam now completely encasing my inverted upper half. Once in Tennessee, having landed in the more conventional upright posture, I spent 6 hours in a paddock, my head protruding above the surface of the earth, being trotted through again and again by three black horses and one roan, who never, during those hours, ceased being panicked by my presence. And yet, I had a fine success on that occasion, my charge being greatly comforted.
That's George Saunders reading from his new book, Vigil. George, what is going on? Who and what is plummeting to Earth?
Well, this is a woman named Jill, nicknamed Doll Blaine, and she, we find out she died in 1976, rather unexpectedly. And so since then, she's kind of been hanging around, and she's kind of like a death doula, except she's dead herself. So she kind of goes to the bedside of people who are in their last hours, and in her construction of it, she's there to offer them comfort. That's her shtick.
And so she plummets to Earth, and as she comes to Earth, she grows arms, she grows legs, she clothes appear. It's quite a violent entry into the end of someone's life.
Yes, I would say none of the characters in the book are at ease exactly. So her particular mode of entry is to kind of, Yeah, kind of just come into being piece by piece from wherever she was before. You know, it's just that kind of thing, just regular old, yeah. I don't know, so weird about it.
What was Jill's life like on Earth? Does she remember a lot about her life?
Well, I mean, part of her deal is that she had an experience at the end of her life that was very transformative. And so she, most of the time, she's in a kind of what she calls elevated state. So she's quite angelic and has a big view, very generous view of everything. But what we find out is there's a little bit of her much regretted life tugging at her all the time. So she's a little bit like, you know, kind of like if an alcoholic walks through a saloon, you know, if she gets too close to human activity, I think she starts to get full of regret and kind of longs to be embodied again, you know.
She's almost resisting remembering life, right?
Yes. You know, she was 22 when she died. She had a nice life, had a husband she loved very much. And so it was just sort of inconceivable to her that she would leave that life. And so in a sense, she's spending this eternity averting her eyes. You know, I don't care about that girl in the past, and she's beneath me, and now I'm this angelic being. So I don't care, except I kind of do, you know, like that.
Do you know, I've been thinking about the fact, George, that none of us really like to think about death, right? It's something that we fear. I find it fascinating that this character, even post-death, still doesn't really want to think about death.
That's right. It still is something that will never happen to her, except that it already did. It's sad. I mean, I can imagine, you know, that the being an older person now and thinking back to being 22 and all the things that have happened to me since then, you know, I have to feel that a person who left early might, you know, conceivably, she anyway has a sense of how much she missed out on. And that's rough, you know. So I kind of love her. I loved her as a character. I miss her already.
Can you tell me what the starting point was for Vigil?
I think it was, you know, these things are sometimes hard to recall, but I think there was a period where I was watching the news, and it was one of those weeks where there were so many weather disasters that it was almost funny, like, oh, okay, climate change isn't real, except everything on the news is climate. And then somehow I just was thinking a little bit about that generation of mostly men who spent a lot of energy denying it, even when they probably knew better, if I did know better. And I guess, you know, kind of thinking, what would that be like to be an 85-year-old retired guy who spent your life somehow in service of denial and then see that on TV? You know, like, would you kind of quickly turn it off, or would you blush, or would you, you know, start talking about something else? And so just that investigation of what people in general do with, I guess, with sin, you know, if you've done something that you, well, and also the way that with age, thought systems that were once very solid to you and true can suddenly just slip away, and you see that you were in the thrall of some idea that you don't believe in anymore. So that was just interesting to me to think about how someone might react in that moment. And then I started looking for, well, who could that be? And, you know, I have some experience in the oil business from when I was younger. So I thought, oh, that might be kind of interesting to sort of go in somewhat sympathetically from my own experience and see where it led.
Mm. So this brings us to who Jill has crashed into Earth to visit. She's visiting this guy, KJ Boone. He's an oil baron, and he is at the end of his life. What do we need to know about this guy?
We're seeing everything about him from his point of view. So it was an interesting technical challenge to say, here's a real stinker. That's the technical term. But I don't get to reach over his head and tell you, dear reader, that I think he's a stinker. I just have to, you know, stay in his head. And what's weird is when you narrate from someone's point of view, they become kind of sympathetic, even if they're terrible. So that was an interesting thing. So he is, I think, you know, one of that generation of people from the kind of George Bush era who were, you know, back when we still had a rule-based system of order. And he would do things kind of within that system, you know, in the same way that Bush, you know, Bush went to Congress to invade Iraq and he went to the UN. This guy kind of played by the rules in a sense, but he also lied his head off and did a lot of deceiving and a lot of propaganda. So, but of course to him, he was just, maybe defending his industry, but we don't know. That was one of the things I was interested to find out. Is somebody like that aware that he's being deceptive, or is the self-talk so convincing that he doesn't think he's being deceptive, and so on? So So he's kind of a, a bad guy. Basically he and people like him delayed any action on climate change for 20 years at a moment when in the States it was about to start being taken seriously when Bush was first president. And then there's some stuff going on behind the scenes and we took a turn in the other direction.
So you describe this guy as a bad guy. You describe him as a stinker. You've also talked about the fact that you spent all this time in his head and you've developed this sense of empathy, perhaps, for him. What does that feel like?
Well, mostly it feels like trying to tell the truth, but you're really trying to, you've got this puppet, this dead puppet, and you're trying to get him to sit up and be believably alive. And that takes up all your time. The empathy, I don't really feel that much empathy for him, but I felt interested in him. And I felt like giving him things to think and say that would make you believe he was an actual person as opposed to a bunch of sentences. So I think that is something like empathy. It's interest. But what I found is you can have a real double or triple or quadruple view of somebody. You can be moved by something that he reveals to you about his childhood at the same time that you think, well, that's not enough to justify what a stinker you are. So it was kind of a really interesting experiment in, I thought of it as kind of like moral pointillism, because at different times in the book, I think you will feel sympathy for him and other times you'll hate his guts. And I like that those things can coexist, because they certainly did in my, in my mind as I was working on them.
And for our fallen angel or whoever she is, this woman who's come to Earth to help him kind of transition to the afterlife, what is she hoping to get from him? Or does she want something from him, or is she just trying to help him get somewhere in death?
Yeah, that's a really perceptive question, because that's what I was learning. I think when I first came up with her, she was just an angel and she had a very vast view of very forgiving view of everybody. Nobody chooses to be bad. Everybody just fulfills their karmic destiny. And so everyone can be forgiven. And also no one should take too much credit for anything. So I kind of believe that in one part of my brain, but then the longer I hung around with her, it seemed a little bit like at times that she was a little selfish. In other words, she's like somebody who gets involved in your life to help you. And it doesn't matter what you think of it, just be quiet and let me help you. So there's a bit of that about her, along with her real sweetness. So I think what I came to love about her and about the book is that I kept not being sure what I thought of these people, even until the last hour. I thought, why? And it came to seem like the game was to just make them more like themselves, more and more and more and more. And if they were contradicting each other, great. If the book seemed to be contradicting itself, great. But I think her thing, I think sometimes she has what we call in Buddhism, idiot compassion, where she thinks if she's just sweet and she's assuaging you, that she's helping you. But in this case, this guy needs some drastic help in those last hours. And I think what we find out is that she's a little too soft to really challenge him.
Luckily, we have some more ghosts or angels who are going to appear who are a bit more serious about holding this guy, KJ Boone, to account. And what they're looking for is repentance, right? You must repent for the sins of your life. Is repentance right. An idea that you buy into, George Saunders?
Yes, if I think of it as hitting bottom, what these other ghosts are trying to do is just in different ways break him. Break KJ Boone so that the healing can begin. If he says, there's a beautiful story, The Death of Ivan Illich, that Tolstoy story that I definitely had in mind while writing this one. And in there, a guy he's dying of what scholars have decided was cancer, stomach cancer. He's in terrible physical pain, but he's also in psychological pain. And there's a beautiful moment where, the whole book he's been saying, but I lived in the right way. I lived in the right way. How can this be happening to me? And at one critical moment, he goes kind of to God, all right. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I didn't live in the right way. But if I didn't, then there must be some way to do it. And as soon as he does that, things get a little better for him. So I think with Boone, the other characters just want him to face the truth for their own reasons. Some just hate him and want him punished. Others would like him to do better. But so it became a real meditation on what does repentance so-called look like and what are the benefits of it.
And talking about words like sin and repentance, of course, it summons up religion, right? And I find this really interesting. So, George, I think you had a very Catholic background.
I did.
And now you're a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
Do Do you spend a lot of time thinking about what happens after you die?
Well, I spent a lot of time writing about it, but for all that, I don't have any idea. I don't have any idea, except that I do feel that maybe mental phenomenon goes on. And, you know, if mental phenomenon goes on for 15 seconds, which I think some scientific studies have shown that actually there's an uptick in brain activity just after death is pronounced, then, you know, that could seem like a long time, depending on how the perception was happening. But these books really, for me, they're not so much about death, really. They're more about life. So I just use it as a way to think about when the train stops, you know, where am I going to be when the train stops? And I mean, mostly they're just for fun, you know, to kind of a sideways meditation about these deep questions.
And you obviously have fun with ghosts too. I mean, there were so many ghosts in Lincoln in the Bardo. Why do authors love ghosts? Like, what do ghosts mean to you when you put a ghost into a story?
Well, for me, it's just a way of artificially broadening the scope. You know, if you have a couple sitting at a kitchen table talking, that's like, all right, you know, but if you put her dead mother in there, suddenly you get a different psychological angle. You get a different sense of time. You know, this woman lived before they did. So somehow it's just, you know, I play guitar a little bit. And one thing I found is, because I'm not that good, but if I play in the key of D, I'm better than if I play in E flat, just because of the way the thing is laid out. So I think this ghost is kind of like that. It's my version of playing in a key that I like. And I don't know why really. I know when I put a ghost in, I feel like, oh, this will be fun, you know, as opposed to, oh, this would be duty.
Well, it's something about memory too, right? I mean, yes. So much of fiction is about memory, and ghosts is a really good way of bringing memory into a story.
Yes, in a very active way, instead of just having some guy sitting drinking coffee remembering. The other thing in this book, there's a lot of, there's a convention that a ghost can enter into a human being and kind of read that person's mind. So that presents some really interesting narrative possibilities. Because in a sense, it's narrated from Jill's point of view, but it's kind of like first person omniscient, because she can go into KJ's mind and then you're in third person indirect through him. So I think for me, you know, I was watching this, there's a documentary about Eddie Murphy here. He's such a brilliant guy. And he was talking about doing voices, that since he was a little kid, he loved to do voices. And I thought, oh yeah, that's right. That's kind of what, for me, what structure is a way to do as many voices as I can. Just an excuse to do different voices. And so I think the ghosts give you so much flexibility in that realm.
Absolutely. And that idea of the ghost being able to drop into someone's body and then see the world from their perspective, that's fascinating. You know, we talk about literature as the opportunity to walk in someone else's shoes. You're taking it whole body experience.
Exactly. They're authors. They're authors flying around. Yeah. Yeah.
I mentioned at the top that you are one of my favorite people to talk to about the act of writing. And I'm keen to know, George, with this book, Vigil, what was the big writing challenge with this novel?
Yes. Well, one thing was I had a lot going on in my life. My father got sick, and we had a couple of sick dogs, and just a lot of really, you know, kind of intense things. And I think because of that, I got stuck a couple times where I didn't have my full concentration. So I got into a place where I had a bunch of good incidents or vignettes, but I couldn't for the life of me figure out the through line. You know, what order should they go in? And that was a first for me. I don't know why, but I think it was in the early phase, it was so fruitful that I produced a lot more material than I normally would. And then it was just like, well, what goes where? And so that was interesting, because I think it made me really think about causation in a book, and there's got to be a best order for these things, and what should it be? So that was fun to get, I mean, fun in quotes, to get so blocked up and go, oh my God, I'm losing my mojo. I never struggled with this before. And then quietly, I could hear the book saying, yes, you're right. I'm giving you a unique challenge, dummy. You know, you're lucky. At your ancient age, I'm giving you a challenge. So yeah, so finally it unknotted itself. And I think it was one of those fruitful lockups, you know, but it was, I guess that's the dream, is to have a different problem with every book, a different insolvable problem with every book.
And is there a voice in the back of your head that goes, I'm George Saunders, I've written the book about writing, I should know what to do here?
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. You dummy, what's wrong? You know, you're a big faker. But there's another voice that says, well, you know, you're doing the best you can. And but of course, part of the idea of this kind of method of writing is that sometimes the more you get stuck, the better you're doing. Because it means that it's like Houdini, you know. If Houdini said, I'm going to now escape from this light t-shirt, it's not a big deal. But the more chains he puts on, you know, and the more coffins he gets inside of, that's interesting. Well, how are you going to get out of that one? So at this stage, I'm kind of like, I'm really happy when a book kind of folds its arms and refuses to be finished, because that doesn't mean it's refusing. It just means it's got something in mind for you, and you have to really submit to it. I mean, you have to say, I know I'm not the boss of you. I'll do it at your pace. And there's something really beautiful about that, especially, you know, as one becomes known for being a teacher and have a Substack and all that, to have a book say, yeah, but you're not my teacher, you know, like that's really kind of wonderful.
There's a scene in Vigil where there are some ghosts that are able to create replica ghosts out of their butts, George Saunders. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know how fun a day it is in the office when you come up with ghosts that kind of, you know, pop more ghosts out of their bums.
It's really fun. It's really fun. Yeah, it was fun. And then, you know, you do that, and then you have to be sort of also a little janitorial about that. I mean, like you say, okay, so is that as good as it can be? Can you get any more fun out of that? And yeah, no, that's the joy of it. I mean, just to have something like that, not to come up with it, because I didn't come up with it. It just came in, and then go, all right, well, I guess, okay. That's you're my book. You can do what you want. It's joyful, really, because, you know, if it was something where you were deliberately saying, I want to be madcap, but that was supposed to be, this was supposed to be a more serious book than it wound up being. So that was cool.
Well, look, it's always a joy to speak to you, George Saunders. Your new book is Vigil. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thanks so much for making the time.
Are we ending on the coming out of the butts thing? Is that what we're doing?
Running? Yeah, we are.
That makes sense. I like it. All right.
Take care.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
On Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols. And Michael Muhammad Ahmed is here now. He is a writer unafraid to put his own story on the page. He's best known for his trilogy of autobiographical novels, The Tribe, The Lebs, and The Other Half of You. He's also been a force in encouraging other people to tell their stories as the founder of the Sweatshop Literacy Movement in Western Sydney. Now Muhammad is back with perhaps the most difficult story of all, a tale of child sexual abuse, which once again draws on his own personal, painful experience. Even the title of this novel is unflinching. It's called Bugger. And before we get into this discussion, a reminder that if this conversation is painful for you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. Muhammad, hello.
Hello, Claire. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to be with you. And I want to start with the end of this book, Muhammad, because instead of acknowledgements at the back of the book, you have unacknowledgements. Why unacknowledgements?
There's two answers to that question. The first one is as a technical exercise for myself as a creative writer. I'm always trying to push my own imagination and the imagination of the reader. And I think acknowledgements at the back of books have become quite commonplace. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you go back even 50 years, it's quite uncommon to find acknowledgements. Now it's a very normal part of the industry. And so I wanted to experiment with the idea of acknowledgements. And there's a lot of unning in the novel itself, a lot of playfulness with the word of undoing. Mm-hmm. And so as a natural extension, I realized that I wanted to write my acknowledgements in that way, an unacknowledgement. The second explanation is a far more personal one, which is, as a matter of fact, I did try and write acknowledgements, literal acknowledgements. I must have written about 30 variations of an acknowledgement, but every time I did, I found myself very overwhelmed emotionally. I just didn't feel like where the book ends and the story as a whole is the kind of story that I could reasonably associate anybody with. Everybody that I love dearly, that I'm grateful towards for having helped me produce this book, I didn't want to taint their name with the tragic story that unfolds.
Yeah, so you write, "How cruel of me to ask any decent person to take credit for such a book. How selfish of me to ask any dignified creature to share its burden." And that word burden is so interesting, Muhammad. How much of a burden was it to write this book?
Thank you for asking me. Just so the audience knows, that's the full unacknowledgements that you just read out. It's two lines. And I spent maybe 2 months playing with those words to get them right, because by the end of the book and by the time the book was completed, it really felt like I was wearing a burden. And it was a burden that I didn't feel it would be fair to ask anybody else to carry. The reason it's a burden is firstly because of the implications on my family, the victims, myself included, and also the perpetrators, and then the enablers, the people around the victims and the perpetrators, and how they participated in the crimes that are depicted in the book. Secondly, on a technical level, as a creative writer, every time I had to work on the book, every time I had to sit down and write in explicit detail some of the scenes, the quite harrowing scenes, I had to relive the story itself. I had to relive the memories. And I think for people outside of the industry who might not fully understand how exactly creative writing works, you know, you prepare your manuscript, you send it to your publisher, they produce their edits, send it back to you, you work on it again, send it back to them, and then they do another round of edits and send it back to you. So you might do that process, you know, 10, 15 times before the book is ready for publication. Mm. And so every single time I had to go through the edits, I would have to relive that experience. And there was one moment where I actually had to call my publisher and say, "Look, I know you've sent me 10 notes this time and I could probably get them done in 24 hours, but actually I'll need 2 weeks because I need you to also factor in that I'm reliving the trauma every time I read the full draft." I should actually shout out to my publisher at this point, Vanessa Radnage, because she held my hand through the entire process and supported me to produce the book that I wanted to produce, with the shocking title and the unusual title and the harrowing text inside without any compromising.
You know, you've talked about the pain of this, the burden of this. Why write this book, Muhammad, when you could, I guess, unburden yourself by not doing so?
So in all fairness, I don't think I could have done this 20 years ago when I first began writing. So quite literally, if you asked me a couple of years ago, the answer would have been no. You know, why write it? I was like, yeah, I agree, I shouldn't write it. Believe it or not, the release of Bugger actually coincides with my 40th birthday. I'll turn 40 this week. And it's taken me 40 years, really, to live the kind of life and develop the education and the skill set, as well as the courage and resilience to put together this book, which, for context for the reader, that the entire book is set over a 24-hour period. The whole novel is one single day. But then the lifetime ramifications of this one single day. So I was ready to tell the story at the time that I started writing it, but it took me my entire life to get here.
Muhammad, I don't want to get into the details of what happened to you when you were a child, but I am interested to know, because I understand this is something that happened within your family unit. Was this something you could talk to other family members about?
Thank you so much for the question. I want to tell you, before I answer it, I want to tell you something. You know, I am literally, I consider myself literally an open book. You know, I always approach my writing as you have to produce your work like you're dead. You can't be afraid of consequences. You have to write in a fearless way if you really want to get to the truth of a matter and convey that truth to your audience. So I want to start by telling you that there's no question that I find offensive. There's no conversation that I would shy away from having. So I appreciate you asking the question. First I want to be very clear. I'm applying this to my value system. I'm not saying this on behalf of any other person. People are very welcome to disagree with what I'm about to say. But I believe, you know, having been in this world for 40 years now, that sexual abuse, the story of sexual abuse, the tragedy of sexual abuse against a child is the worst thing that can happen to a family. Mm. And I come from a family where we've had many tragedies. We've lost loved ones to cancer way sooner than we'd ever expected to lose a loved one. We've lost loved ones to car accidents and motorcycle accidents. We've lost loved ones, relatives in the Middle East throughout, you know, the ongoing conflicts. We've lost family members and loved ones and people within our community, even to things like organized crime. But my experience of all of those tragedies is that it always brings the family together. You know, whether it's at home or at the funeral or at the cemetery, in the days, the weeks, the months, and sometimes even in the years after, family members are literally holding each other, consoling each other, checking in on each other, bringing food over for one another. But the reason I argue that the worst thing that can happen to a family is sexual abuse is, for example, discovering that your brother has been assaulting your daughter or your nephew has been assaulting your son. The reason I argue that that's the worst thing that can happen to a family is because it's the kind of story that doesn't bring a family together. It's the kind of story that absolutely tears an entire family apart. Not least of all, and this is the probably the most important detail, not least of all, because in many cases, family members will side with and protect the perpetrator over the victim.
That's got to be so difficult, especially for a child to make sense of that.
You know, actually, that is spot on when we talk about this book. I wrote it in the first person perspective of a 10-year-old boy, and I wrote it in the present tense. I didn't write it with an older narrator or an older voice, unlike my three other novels, who has the power of hindsight. I really wanted to immerse the reader sensitively. I want to emphasize that I did write it very delicately and sensitively because I was aware of the pain that some readers might go through. But I wrote it in the first person, present tense perspective of a 10-year-old boy because I really wanted to show the confusion, not just the pain, but the confusion that a child goes through. And where the book ends, I feel is a call to action, actually. You know, it ends with a request from the reader to ask themselves, how would they write that final chapter? How would you as a reader respond and take action if a child who has gone through this came to you with this information?
So as you say, this book unfolds over 24 hours. We're with Hamoudi, who is a gorgeous boy, having a bit of a tough time at school, but just a really open-hearted, lovely boy. Where's Hamoudi's dad?
So there's actually, we've talked a little bit about sexual abuse as the central theme of the book. There's a sub-theme in the book, which is about censorship and the climate of censorship. I want to be clear that I don't preach to my audiences in my writing. There's no preaching about child abuse. There's no preaching about censorship. But over the last few years, particularly during the human-made catastrophe that we're witnessing in Palestine and surrounding countries, like the country my family are from, Lebanon, there's been this unnerving climate of censorship and speech suppression. And obviously we saw that on a national scale and a huge national conversation about it in the writing community very recently when actually a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Randa Abdul Fattah, was uninvited from her participation in the Adelaide Writers' Week. So I wanted to capture that climate of censorship, that feeling, that environment of censorship. And I used primarily the father character to do that. He's written as a journalist, and he's disappeared. It's not clear where he is, and Hamoudi is searching for him quite literally, but also metaphorically. Like the presence of his father is always there, the ghost. And there is a sub-narrative about what happened to him and who he may be and where he's gone.
Mm. And Hamoudi's mum is present, but very distant, I think it's fair to say. She has her own pain to deal with, and I found this character extremely moving. Have you met parents like this, Mohammed, parents whose pasts do force this distance between them and their children?
Yes, actually, my parents, I draw connections between my parents and the parents of Hamoudi that I created. But I also, this time with these particular parents, both Hamoudi's mother and father, I grew up in quite a working class and even welfare class family where none of my family members were educated. I was the first one in my extended family. That's, you know, the hundreds of us, you know, my parents, siblings, aunties, uncles, cousins. I was the first one to obtain a university education. And so, you know, I wasn't used to having very intellectual, you know, scholarly, academic, well-read adults around me growing up. But the Arab Australian community that that exists today, you know, it's this incredibly vibrant, educated, resilient, intellectual ecosystem that we have created. And there's so many amazing Arab Australian writers, for example, many of whom I would presume you've interviewed. And over the last few years, with all the tragedy that our community has faced and confronted, I really wanted to write these two parents as a love letter to them, you know, to this amazing generation of Arab Australians who are coming up now, who are deep thinkers and who are capable of deconstructing complex information and producing counter narratives, important counter narratives. So I know those parents as both representative of the generation that came before me, but also as representatives of the generation of Arab Australians that we are right now.
The act of putting this story on the page, has that given you any sense of healing or relief to do that?
Not yet. Part of my maybe unhealthy philosophy of writing like you're dead, part of that is to shut out any potential consequences that might come of it. You know, I strongly believe that if a writer isn't 100% truthful in what they are trying to communicate to their audience, then by extension, the audience won't believe what they're saying. And so you have to be willing to open yourself up, to be completely vulnerable, and to confront the darkest elements of your lived experiences and your reality. But if I spent too much time thinking about the possible outcomes of that, how it might affect me or affect certain people in my life that I care for dearly, I think I would get cold feet and prevent myself from doing it or going all the way with what I need to communicate. So I tend to try and block out that possibility while I'm creating the work and while the book is causing whatever trouble it needs to cause, both positive and negative. Mm. And so what I hope to do is in a year or two when I have gone through this experience with the audience who read the work and we've had the conversations, I'll have a bit more clarity on the impact it will have on me. But I do want to say one thing that I think is quite hopeful. You know, Claire, over the last couple of days of the book already being out in the public, I've been receiving a lot of emails from people in the public who have stumbled upon the book or stumbled upon a news story about the book. The first thing they do is they thank me for having the courage to come forward and tell this story. And then they share their own story of their own personal experience of abuse or the experience of somebody they love who's been through abuse. And I think that if the book can provide an opportunity for us as a country to have the conversation, to find the confidence and the courage to come forward, and in doing so, destigmatizing this widespread issue, I think that could ultimately lead to justice for victims and prevention for future victims.
Wow. Thank you so much. Michael Mohammed Ahmed, your book is called Bugger and it's published by Hachette. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for this interview, Claire. Thank you for your sensitivity in engaging in this work with me. And I'm sending my love to all the people across Australia who have a similar story to my own. And I also want to let them know that inside the book, there are also resources for anybody who needs help and support.
And can I wish you a happy 40th too?
Thank you so, so much. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for joining me for The Book Show today. If you love the show, make sure you're following us on ABC Listen. Thank you to producer Sarah Lestrange. My name is Claire Nichols, and we make this show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.